This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium, dear friends. And welcome to The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett, and I promise you, if you stick around for the duration and maintain an open mind, not so open mind that your brains fall out, but an open mind, you may just have your reality redefined, at least slightly shaken. At the very least, what you hear will make you go, hmm. You might even, if you're not careful, be entertained. Here's something else that will redefine your reality, and it promises to be a whole lot of fun. Follow the Truth, the Conspiracy Show Summit, November the 16th at the Regent Theater in Oshawa. Hosted by yours truly, tickets now on sale. I'll be bringing six absolutely amazing speakers to town, and you can witness their mind-blowing presentations all in one day under one roof in one beautiful and intimate setting, the historically and recently refurbished Regent Theater in downtown Oshawa. So if you're into time travel, the Roswell UFO crash, Rendlesham Forest, the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, or as it's known in the United States, the Bentwaters Air Force Base UFO incident, if you're into crop circles, the Matrix, giants, gosh, who wouldn't be into giants? If that stuff is of even the slightest passing interest, you don't want to miss Follow the Truth, the Conspiracy Show Summit. Please visit www.followthetruth.tv for more details or to order tickets. And you can email me for more info at followthetruthsummit@gmail.com. And just less than 24 hours away from the debut of Season 3 of the Conspiracy Show television program, debuting across Canada on Vision TV, 10 p.m. Eastern. All right. Sometimes it's not enough to sit and listen and watch. I understand that. Sometimes we feel the very strong urge to actually do something with what we learn. Take chemtrails, for instance, or false flag operations, or, I don't know, the financial shenanigans that corrupt Wall Street players and their bosses have been involved with. I talk about these things a lot on this show and on the television program, and you listen and watch intently, and for that I'm truly grateful. But you're probably thinking to yourself, okay, I believe chemtrails are real. I believe that powerful, wealthy, secretive elites are orchestrating these things, but what can I do about it? Or what is being done about it? How are these corrupt, evil individuals responsible for these things ever going to be brought to justice? How? Well, for the next 45 minutes or so, my next guest is going to answer those questions because he's a human rights advocate, and he's here to discuss his efforts to create an enforceable global human rights court. And such a court would have the statutory authority to prosecute the oligarchs responsible for such human rights violations as the aforementioned chemtrails, false flags, various financial crimes, Michael Henry Dunn is a scholar, author, musician, and a globally recognized commentator on issues of human rights. His advocacy for the movement to support national sovereignty embodied in the Non-Alignment Movement and BRICS Alliance led to his current position as senior editor for the Alliance Journal, a university educational institution which serves as an academic journal, digest, news source, and debate forum to facilitate the realization of a more free, peaceful, and abundant world for all humanity. Michael Dunn, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thanks very much. Great to be here.
You are a true scholar. You studied at Juilliard. And I think of people like yourself and Daniel Sheehan, who's been on this program. I don't know if you know Daniel at all. Let's go back. People like Marshall McLuhan. One thing that these great minds, and I include you in that, all share is you believe that there is this elite group, oligarchs, unelected oligarchs, who are trying to stage manage events backstage and perpetrate great evil upon humankind. And I find that encouraging, actually, that there are people like yourself out there, scholars.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering, do you have a problem with the word conspiracy? I mean, this is The Conspiracy Show. A lot of people do. They have trouble with that word.
No, I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with the way it has been used to create a label that is automatically discredited. All you need to do, as we know well, to debunk something is to say, oh, that's the conspiracy theorists. And, of course, all it means, conspire in its roots linguistically means to breathe together, right?
Right. Now,
and if you turn it around and simply ask someone, no, I'm not into conspiracies, I'm just into identifying groups that act out of common interest, which people can say, oh, well, okay, well, that makes sense. But, there is certainly a lot of dramatic value to the word conspiracy. There's a lot of entertainment value to the word conspiracy. And as defined in the dictionary, it's accurate for what we're describing. So actually, conspiracy is a totally appropriate word for us to use. But, starting back shortly before Dallas, before JFK was killed, it was likely very intentionally floated as a label to discredit those who were seeing what was truly going on. So, as we know, the handy label conspiracy theorists is automatically wacky, is the connotation that is very effectively conveyed these days. So it's both ways. It's inaccurate, it's accurate by the dictionary, but it's been abused to discredit the movement.
Sure, it's used by the mainstream, if you will, in the pejorative,
right.
and as a weapon to stifle debate. And Lord knows we need honest debate right now.
Yeah.
Let's just dive right in here because time is limited. Unfortunately, I need a 5-hour show one day. But let's talk about this Global Human Rights Court. People might be sitting back and say, "Well, wait a minute, we have one. It's in The Hague. Don't we already have one of those, Michael?"
Yes, we have a number of human rights courts. We have an International Court of Justice, and we have the International Criminal Court, and we have the European Court of Human Rights, and we have the United Nations Human Rights Council, and all these international courts. And they are designed essentially to be ineffective in addressing the systemic human rights violations by which the cabal accomplishes its daily operations. Since time is limited, if you like, Richard, what I can do here is quickly give you the limitations of those courts. I'll try to make it a 30-second soundbite. How does that sound?
Well, we have a little more than 30 seconds. If you need a couple,
okay.
If you need 3 minutes, please do so because this is important.
Okay, well, let's go with the International Court of Justice, right? Now, this has jurisdiction only for countries to bring claims against other countries, right? So for, suffering humanity, that is not necessarily an answer. And it does not permit individuals to file a claim against the country for human rights violations. You take the International Criminal Court. It has jurisdiction only for war crimes, and it is not a forum for any claims by individual victims of human rights violations in private cases. And, you know, if you look at how many cases are actually tried in the ICC, they tend to be predominantly darker-skinned people, and they are few and far between in terms of the cases that are actually processed. Meanwhile, everything that you cover on your show, right? Well, not everything, but many of the things you cover on your show, from chemtrails to false flags, these are actually specific violations of international human rights law that is binding on all UN member nations. And these go unaddressed. There is no forum by which these violations right now can be effectively addressed. And, you know, that is what the Arbitration Court of International Justice, which has statutory authority under international law, and I can go into that if you like, that is what this court has been designed to address, are the systemic violations of these international laws, and to effectively prosecute them.
If I might, let me throw this out onto the fire as well, and you can disabuse me of this if I'm off base, but I think one of the other limitations of these international courts that you've discussed is that they are often used as well in the ongoing effort to destroy the nation state. For example, if we look at what happened in Yugoslavia and how that that country was torn apart, and I mean, I don't know if you are in agreement on this, and if not, please tell me. But I just think that that's an important limitation, that these courts, to my mind, are often used to bludgeon, to aid in the dismantling of nation states. We have Tony Blair speaking, I believe it was in Ohio, a number of years when he first introduced this humanitarian doctrine, which has been used in places like Libya. Which was anything but a humanitarian effort.
Right.
You know, we must invade to protect people. What are your thoughts on that? That humanitarian doctrine and a lot of these international courts are used to destroy the nation state.
Well, I can't really comment on anything, you know, specific actions by the international courts that allowed that. I can agree with you, you know, definitely that a humanitarian front, you know, is a humanitarian excuse, a screen. Is used as the excuse, you know, for example, what's happening in Ukraine, you know, in the Western media.
Yes.
Of course, it was, you know, played up as these, you know, freedom fighters going against these, you know, Russian-backed people who wanted to prevent all the good Ukrainians from allying with their friends in Europe. Well, it was a NATO destabilization operation. There were snipers, you know, who were killing people on both sides, and there's witnesses to this, who, you know, simply to destabilize the situation. And it was, in fact, a neo-fascist coup that overthrew a democratically elected government, which we and the West promptly cheered on, and suddenly Vladimir Putin is Adolf Hitler, you know. So that kind of manipulation of our human sympathy through the humanitarian pose, you know, is something that does happen quite a lot.
All right, Michael, stay put. When we come back on the other side, let's drill down and discuss what this court, this Global Human Rights Court, would look like. Let's talk about the statutory authority to prosecute the oligarchs responsible for such human rights violations as chemtrails, false flags, various financial crimes, how it would work, how we bring it about, most importantly, how we get this done. Back with more of my conversation with Michael Henry Dunn here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away. Welcome back. We are speaking with Michael Henry Dunn and his efforts to bring about a human rights court, not the typical human rights court that seems incapable of bringing real tyrants to justice. And when I say tyrants, now I'm talking about sort of the unseen hand, the unelected oligarchs, perhaps attendees at a Bilderberg meeting. Perhaps they may have a chair at a Council on Foreign Relations meeting. These are the people that we believe are ostensibly behind things like chemtrails, depopulation programs, false flag operations. Michael, how would this court be constructed? What would it look like? How would it operate?
Well, when you're enumerating these crimes that you were just talking about, Richard, about false flags, chemtrails, etc., as I mentioned earlier, these are specific violations of existing international laws. And one of the first major contributions that the Arbitration Court of International Justice is going to make is within probably a couple of months, the court will be publishing, actually it will be not specifically the court that would be publishing it, it will be published by Ignita Veritas University, which is a licensed university, but will be publishing a judge's manual of human rights enforcement. And that will be listing and documenting all of the international human rights laws which are on the books, which are binding on all UN member nations, and which go unenforced. And we will not only be enumerating these specific violations, but exactly what the statutory authority is whereby the court can actually, through due process, you know, prosecute these crimes. So let me just elaborate a little to say, okay, how does the court go about that? The other courts, you know, that we're familiar with, the ICJ, the ICC, these are treaty-based courts, right? Which means the way they were constructed in the beginning is the countries agreed voluntarily to submit to the jurisdiction of the court. Now, this allowed for the easy creation, right, and also the immediate funding of a court that countries all kick in, right? But it's severely limited by allowing countries to just avoid its jurisdiction, you know, at their will and convenience, as we've seen the United States, you know, has already done. So, you know, that is one way to create a court, but what most people do not know, it is not the only way. There are specific provisions of international law enacted by the UN General Assembly that can fully authorize and empower an independent, non-governmental court to exercise jurisdiction over matters of international law. Now, there are three major hurdles that any court will have to pass, according to international law, to actually have statutory authority. And I'm saying statutory as opposed to treaty-based, right? And those three things are: a court must first have an official licensed status as a non-governmental court from a national ministry of justice of a UN member country. So, you know, here in the United States, that would be, you know, like going to Eric Holder and say, listen, Eric, you know, we're really fed up with the cabal. We've seen all these massive violations of human rights. What we need from you and the Justice Department of the U.S. government, just give us a license to operate as a non-governmental court of international justice so we can go after these guys, right? No problem with that, right? So, of course, this is not going to happen.
Yes, because some people think Eric Holder is part of the cabal.
Yeah, some people would think, well, you know, cabinet officers, no comment. You know, it's more likely than not. But
we'd have better luck. Let's go to Iceland, Michael. I mean seriously, they
know how to handle it in Iceland, right?
Apparently,
yeah. So the arbitrator, the ACIJ, as I'll refer to it for convenience, has that official license status as an NGO court from a national ministry of a UN member nation. Secondly, it has to have formal UN registered status as an NGO. Third, it has to have, and this is probably the most important thing in terms of functioning as an actual credible court of human rights law, it has to have an infrastructure and a foundational basis which is fully consistent with all details of the relevant body of international law. In other words, you know, it needs to have, you know, the entire structure that, you know, the other international courts have with international judges, you know, due process, chambers of investigating judges, etc. And so these are difficult hurdles to meet. This is not the reason I go into all this is that, you know, in the freedom movement, we've become kind of desperate. You know, it's like, okay, we'll have to go to common law. We're going to have to go to citizens' grand juries. We're just going to have to go out and, you know, get some friends and the cops and the local sheriffs to do mass arrests, you know, which they very much want us to feel as if we are pushed off to that ineffective fringe, you know, where it is simply an excuse to trigger a crackdown. That is where they would much rather push the freedom movement off to, push the awakening population off to. What they don't want, you know, is a sober, authoritative, mainstream enforcement of the rule of law by the human family. That's their worst nightmare, is essentially what's happening here. And so, you know, we are, to some extent, taking this mainstream in that we are working with what a lot of people in the freedom movement perceive as tainted institutions. Oh, you know, don't tell me about the UN, that's a cabal-created institution. Yeah, we know that. We know about, you know, the founding and structure and history of that, and it also happens to represent, you know, the entire population of the planet.
But you just need one member of the General Assembly, one member nation of the General Assembly to get this done? Am I understanding that correctly?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that. You know, we do have the aforementioned license, and we do have the NGO status, and we do have the foundational basis required. That's all in international law, and that triggers statutory authority. In other words, it derives from the statute itself. All the criteria have been met, therefore it has statutory authority. In terms of, all you need is one country. Now, there are, you know, like 170 countries in the non-aligned movement. You know, there is the BRICS alliance. There is, you know, the planet is waking up, and there is, you know, widespread and growing awareness of the oligarchy, who they are, what they do, what their agenda is. And so this is not, you know, about some lone band of would-be heroes trying to set up some court. This is about the human family coming together under the rule of law to enforce existing human rights law through existing institutions. So, and that is actually kind of revolutionary, you know, in the current, I mean, in a good way, not as in, you know, we're waving bloody flags and storming the Bastille, but as in it's seizing the one lever that is actually going to make a difference. And, you know, I can't go into a lot of operational details about exactly how would we proceed, which countries, you know, are our allies, what we're doing. You know, obviously there's people listening to your show, you're well aware of it, you know, who would try to counter such moves. But essentially, you know, the strategy I'm happy to share with people, that is what I would encourage people to open their minds to, that it is these mainstream institutions by which we can actually enact effective change, by which we can actually push back as the human family and enforce the rule of law, are through these existing institutions that they want us to think have been tainted. Oh, it's the UN, now throw that out. You know, oh, it's the Catholic Church, throw that out. Oh, it's, you know, it has to do with the UK. You know, oh, that's the, you know, the Illuminati-tainted Windsor clan or whatever. You know, this is, all that does is push us to the ineffective lunatic fringe, which is just where they want us to be.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I know sort of, and I hate using the term community when we're talking about conspiracies, because it's not an appropriate term. There is no such thing as a conspiracy community. There are simply people who are aware and who care. But it doesn't matter what area you delve into, whether it's and I don't know if you have any feelings one way or the other about the whole UFO issue, but if you go into the UFO community, again, for lack of a better term, there is so much divisiveness, so much infighting, that it's hard to get anything done. So, and I believe you're absolutely spot on, that that's what these oligarchs, they want, and they are seeding this dissent.
They actively, you know, they have well-funded operations that, you know, that enact that stuff, that put out the disinformation, put out, you know, create the infighting. That's,
right.
You know, that's a controlled opposition.
We're so busy fighting ourselves that we lose our...
And so another thing that we're doing, like through the Alliance Journal, which as an academic journal, as part of Dignita Veritas University, within the university, you know, to have academically sound, footnoted, referenced, annotated articles that cite, you know, mainstream sources of evidence for these cabal crimes, that cite, you know, parliamentary reports, mainstream articles, that just, and it's, there's tons of this out there, that cut through all that fog you're talking about, Richard, that they create in order to keep us confused and at each other's throats. If there's a mainstream organ, you know, that is putting out credible information, fact-based, that scholars can go to, and use its academic references for further research, that's a big shift. That pulls us away from the conspiracy fringe and puts us mainstream, where people say, ah, okay, this is for real. These are solid, checkable facts, and, you know, now we can do something about it.
Well, I mean, you would have no shortage of volunteer investigators, and I'm not talking about amateurs here. I'm talking about, you know, professional investigators, researchers who could, you know, put together some pretty compelling cases, but which leads me to the next area of inquiry, and that is, and again, we're getting into the mechanics here, and I don't know how far we can go with this, but walk me through how this court would work. Let's say someone comes to the court with a pretty compelling case of, and I'm not going to name names here, but inside the 9/11 was essentially aided and abetted by someone on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And it may have been within the White House or the Pentagon or some other agency. And in this report, they name names and they've got documentation and so forth. Where does it go from there? How would it operate?
Okay. The question that always comes up in people's minds when they're looking at this is, okay, tell me about enforceability. Great, because there have been, for example, the court in Malaysia that indicted Bush. Great, an indictment, and it sits there, and it's useless, and nothing happens. If a case like the example that you know, going to 9/11 as the first case would probably not be a course I would expect the court to take. But again, I am not the court. I am not a lawyer or a judge. You know, I'm an adjunct professor with the university and the senior editor of the Alliance Journal. So I just want to be very clear that, you know, that I am not speaking officially for the court. I'm a volunteer spokesman, and I'm, you know, the editor of the journal. But supposing that due process having been observed, the foundational basis having been observed, you know, we are not talking about some, you know, swift kangaroo court judgment like you hear people making against some of these people out there. But that judgment having been rendered, supposing that assets are to be seized, a judgment has been rendered, assets are to be seized, or someone, an arrest warrant is made against a cabal chieftain, shall we say. Now, in all probability, serving that judgment on assets to be seized in the United States is obviously a very long shot. We're not likely to get cooperation from the U.S. government in its current form. However, there are 170 nations in the non-aligned movement, and all it takes is one, just one, of those nations to be willing to recognize the statutory authority of the court and to seize assets of the offending country or individual within its territory. For example, embassies have assets, embassies have accounts, embassies have funds. There are any number of other, because, you know, we are talking about obviously a fairly complex array of possible perpetrators. So I can't get too specific about how an enforcement, you know, would proceed. But that is, you know, the mechanism whereby the human family, the non-aligned movement, starts to act. And once people see that begin to happen, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people, names we both know that I won't go into, you know, on the good side here, to say, you know, really, there are powerful people who are sitting on the fence. They know the shift is coming. They know, you know, that the pressure on the oligarchs is increasing. And at some point, somebody's going to do something effective, and we're going to see somebody doing a perp walk, or we're going to see somebody seeing his assets seized, and there's going to be, you know, a lightning awareness that's shooting through, you know, either the U.S. or the world, that the jig is up. And you're going to see a lot of these fence sitters jumping. And when that moment happens, I cannot predict, nor if I could, would I, here on the air. But that is essentially the mechanism. And, you know, I can't go into a lot of operational detail beyond that, just for security reasons, which, you know, I'm sure you can appreciate.
All right. We'll come back and discuss further. I'll tell you what, as we head into the break, though, even if I don't see assets being seized, even if I don't see individuals doing the perp walk, just to see an actual trial, maybe it's in absentia, I don't know if that's you know, would be within the protocol of such a court. But just to see an actual trial, a real investigation and a trial, I think for a lot of people, that would be enough, at least to start
with.
Yeah,
and it would be conducted by, you know, international judges, certified international judges. We're not going to ask them to put their lives on the line. And we're not going to be identifying these folks right, you know, this second. But, yeah, this will be, you know, ironclad international law process.
All right, we'll come back. More of my conversation with Michael Henry Dunn here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Yes, keeping an eye on the New World Order indeed. In fact, not just enough to keep an eye on them. We've got to take the next step, which is to put them on the stand, subpoena them, put them on the witness stand, prosecute them, and hopefully put some of these evildoers behind bars for a very long time. Is that possible? Is that within the realm of possibility? Well, my guest, Michael Henry Dunn, thinks so, and the first step is the creation of this International Human Rights Court that he's been discussing here on the program. Now, I mentioned 9/11, and you said, well, that may be just, you know, a little bit too much to chew first time go around for such a court. Could you give me an example of one of these New World Order crimes that you think would be a good place to start, some place you'd like to see them start?
Financial crimes. You know, that's what's happening with the bank accounts of ordinary people. You know, the way access to your money is being blocked, the way withdrawals beyond a certain sum are suddenly forbidden, the way the laws that were put in place after 9/11, you know, in the name of anti-money laundering laws to prevent money from going to terrorists, were used, in fact, to begin to limit the ability of ordinary people, ordinary, honest, peace-loving, tax-paying folks, to get used to a level of governmental or, you know, essentially banking interference in their freedom to use their money. Essentially, you know, your money in the bank is actually no longer yours. The bank can deny you access to it.
We are now investors, not depositors.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I saw a performance in Los Angeles by an activist who does who protests against mass incarceration, and he's a lawyer, Harvard-trained lawyer, African American, and he said, you know, what happened after 9/11 is that, you know, you white folks out there, basically, after 9/11, it was what he called the niggeration of America. Said, now all you white folks know what it's like to be pulled over and stopped for no reason, to have driver's license checkpoints on peaceful highways, and to have psychological pressure put on you such that now, oh, well, this is the new normal, right? So these are, you know, some of the effects of these financial violations, and these are specific violations of existing international law. You know, and they imagine that they are impervious to prosecution, that they can hide behind a corporate veil, that they can hide behind a governmental veil, and in fact, that is not true. I'm not going to, you know, again, this is when the judge's manual for human rights enforcement comes out shortly, you know, your audience will be able to see the details, and it's, you know, it's a very definitive work, and we're eager to bring it to you.
Do you have any I don't know if you can answer this question, Michael, but I'll throw it out there anyway. Do you have any candidates for judges to sit on this in mind? I mean, can you see anyone out there on the landscape?
There's no way I would mention a name. I would never do that.
Okay.
I would never do that. No, I mean, these are brave people who would be putting their lives on the line. And there are, you know, actual existing guidelines and protocols whereby these cases could be tried with their identity being protected.
Oh, is that right?
Judicial immunity.
Ah.
Yes, these are, you know, it's, again, I want to again give the caveat here. I am not an international judge or lawyer. I'm a journalist and a human rights advocate.
I understand. So, and my knowledge of the...
Just trying to tread a little carefully about this. But no, unfortunately, of course, I would not give you any names.
And my knowledge of you know, jurisprudence is a mile wide, but a millimeter deep. So I'm treading on very thin ice here. But having a judge sit on a panel where he would be anonymous, I mean, isn't that contrary to just the foundations of law?
Yeah, you know, because law by definition has to be public. You know, that's the idea. I'm actually going to pass on getting specific with that answer, if you'll forgive me, Richard, because I have looked at the legal basis, you know, whereby that is actually acceptable under international law, but I frankly do not feel competent as an, you know, international judge would be the best one to answer that question. We do have you know, experts that I can refer to you on that if you prefer a follow-up visit on your show, if you like. But I'm going to pass on that.
No, that's fair enough. Fair enough. It's just it's an interesting talking point, and it one that we should definitely pursue at some point. And I would love to have to do another program on this. Let me ask how people. I mean, we're going to break here in a second and come back for one more stretch. But in the meantime, how do people get involved and get behind this, and what can they do?
Okay. Well, right now, the Arbitration Court of International Justice, the ACIJ, as an autonomous subdivision of Ignita Veritas University, you know, does indeed have a donation page. At the moment, can I give the website, the web address?
Please do.
That be helpful?
Please do.
Okay. The web address is www.isis, as in ISLEXAM -security.org. Now, you're probably hearing the acronym ISIS.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's rather unfortunate.
Right. So that stood for the Institute for Sovereign International Security.
And luckily, the rampaging ISIS.
Yeah, it might as well be called the Adolf Hitler Institute.
Well, they've changed their name, thankfully. They're no longer ISIS. They're now ISIL. So we're off the hook.
Well, it doesn't make any difference because Obama went on the air calling them at a press conference calling them ISIS the other day, and now all the Western media is referring to them as ISIS.
Listen, I got the music coming up. We'll come back.
So anyway, but to cut to the chase.
Yeah.
So the Ignita Veritas University is a licensed international university. It carries a number of licenses, which, you know, for time's sake, I won't go into. But to go to the website, that is still the web address. We are about to be shifting to the new one.
Okay, I've got to go into a break here, Michael. Forgive me. Forgive me. I've got to go into a break here. When we come back, I'll get you to repeat that. We'll repeat the website for sure when we come back. Okay, Michael Dunn, my guest here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. Okay, now, Michael, we can proceed uninterrupted till the top of the hour. Let's, first order of business, get that website out again, and I'm going to immediately post it at richardserrett.com.
Okay, great. It's isis-security.org, isis-security.org, and then click on the Justice Court page, which will take you to the ACIJ page. And if you scroll down, you will see a donation button to donate. And it is tax-exempt, to the Public Access to Justice Endowment, or PAGE, Public Access to Justice, that's the whole point. That is the fund of the tax-exempt Arbitration Court of International Justice, ACIJ, Human Rights Court. And there's a donate button right there.
And in the meantime, if they simply go to the homepage, they can learn all about the court as well?
Right. They can learn all about the full scope of what the institution of Ignita Veritas University, which, you know, has a number of licenses and functions that will be of interest.
All right. I am posting that right as we speak. Now, what people need to do, if they don't go right to the website, if they just want to go to richardserrett.com, if you're on the site right now listening at home and following at home, just go to on the homepage and under tonight's show, and you'll see the heading for the first hour of the program, Crimes of the New World Order, and you'll scroll down and you'll see our guest's name, Michael Henry Dunn.
And Richard, may I just add also, the Alliance Journal also will be a helpful spot to stop at, and that is thealliancejournal.org.
thealliancejournal.org. All right, I'll post that as well. But as we speak now, if they click on your name, Michael Henry Dunn, that will take you to the ISIS website.
Great. Well, yeah. Ignita Veritas University. Okay, we're trying to drop the ISIS brand.
Okay.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. All right, I understand. So, again, not a lot of time here, but give me the Reader's Digest version of how you, you know, having studied at Juilliard, you're a musician. I've seen your some remarkable interviews talking about the, you know, the whole authorship of Shakespeare, which is a I'd love to have you back on and talk about that for an hour if you're up for it sometime, because that's a fascinating area. How do you go from that world into this world?
Well, there's some really interesting parallels. Because essentially it's a quote-unquote conspiracy theory, right? And as a trained classical actor, and I was a, you know, I worked professionally in Shakespeare repertory companies, I blew the whole thing off. I thought it was this, you know, stupid, wacky theory that these snobs who couldn't accept that, you know, a kid from a provincial town could come in and be a genius playwright. But when you look at the facts, you know, you have a unique problem with the Shakespeare authorship. So in studying that and in eventually becoming more or less a recognized authority on the Shakespeare authorship question, you know, I'm cited in several books that are out there. What you see is an entrenched special interest defending its turf by discrediting people who are pointing out facts of you know, quote-unquote lost history, right? So that background and training eventually became a trustee of the Shakespeare Fellowship, which is a not-for-profit organization of scholars studying the question. When it rolled around to 2011, and I became aware of the currency reset rumor, by that time, I had studied enough of what was going on with the false flag situation to realize that much as I did not want to believe it, you know, the story we were given on 9/11 was a story. And once I began to research the financial reset, I started to write for blogs that later put me in touch with Neil Keenan. And Neil, you know, was impressed with my work and asked me to write a preface to his lawsuit. The $1 trillion lawsuit, which David Wilcock covered in Financial Tyranny. And so that's how I started to work with Neil, and then I went to Jakarta, Indonesia, and, you know, on the ground with Neil there in early 2013 for several months. And that's when, you know, I was writing a lot of journalism from that location about what was going down with Neil's efforts to, you know, put the control of the global collateral accounts in the hands of the right people. So that background, essentially, I had a pretty thorough training in the information war, because the same tactics are used. It's a very similar situation.
Well, in other words, you're in a very unique position because you were on the other side as a debunker. Although the issue now was the authorship of Shakespeare, and those people that would come to you and say, no, Shakespeare couldn't have written these. His children were illiterate. He wasn't well-traveled. He had no knowledge of the law. He couldn't speak Latin. There's no contemporary documents and so forth. You would just sort of laugh that off or use some sort of a straw man argument and employ same tactics. Oh, that's interesting.
I was one of those people. And then until I read a book called The Mysterious William Shakespeare by Charlton Ogburn, the best book out there right now, newly published by Gotham, mainstream publisher, is Shakespeare by Another Name. Again, that is Shakespeare by Another Name by Mark Anderson, The Life of Edward de Vere, Earl of Oxford, who is actually the writer behind the Shakespeare canon.
Yeah, I've heard you sort of outline all the evidence. Not all of it, a little bit of the evidence, which is overwhelming in and of itself. But, I mean, you're right. The parallels there are amazing because let's for example, talk about, 9/11. And it's, you know, it's the old story about how these conspiracies are really, they're not conspiracies. They're out there in plain sight. Yet there is some sort of psychological blinder that we all have. We put on whether it's a self-preservation mechanism, which I think is a large part of it. I mean, I guess because we all have a vested interest. When you were a Shakespearean actor, you had a vested interest.
Oh, sure.
We all live this lifestyle, as some might call it, a profligate lifestyle here in the West, and so we, you know, deny conspiracies are perpetrated by people with turbans, not us. So I guess that's what it is, isn't it? It's a self-preservation mechanism. That's what prevents us from seeing the truth.
Yeah, very much.
Where do we go from here, Michael? What's the next step to get this? I mean, I guess you're in the initial stages of just bringing public awareness about this court. But walk me through what the next steps and when might we actually see this come into fruition?
Well, within probably a couple of months, you will see the judge's manual of human rights enforcement be coming out from Ignatia Veritas University. And that will be distributed to human rights activists, human rights lawyers worldwide, and at that point, you know, there's one very important piece that we are putting in place very carefully, which is the charter of the court, which is the definitive statement of its, you know, foundational basis and authority, and, you know, that cannot be something that is less than fully ironclad and definitive. This brings up one thing I'd love to just emphasize here, Richard, which is that, you know, in the freedom movement, we all get excited about one personality or another who's out there as the hero of the moment, right? And, you know, these are brave people, and not to knock them, you know, but, you know, whether it's David Wilcock or it's Neil Keenan or it's, you know, some of these inside whistleblowers who are putting their lives on the line, that is gutsy, courageous stuff, and I admire them. But, you know, a reliance upon personalities makes us very vulnerable. What we need are institutions that are trustworthy and transparent, that will last centuries, that can, you know, have the trust of the human family. And that's what we're putting in place. And, you know, we're not going to rush it. You know, we recognize the extreme urgency of what's going on. We're in the middle of, you know, an intense struggle. And, you know, we're in touch with people who want to see this authority established so that it can begin to be used promptly. And for your audience out there, you know, we are not funded by nations contributing, you know, to a treaty-based court where it's like, cover our butts and, you know, here's your million to, you know, keep you in business. You know, we rely on donations. So we can certainly be greatly assisted in how fast this comes to fruition by folks going to that page and helping us make it happen, you know, because it currently, you know, we are working with very committed information warriors who, like a lot of us out there, are doing it, you know, in our spare time from what we have to do to bring in income. So that would be what I would encourage people to realize, that we need to create durable institutions based in international law that have the trust of the people. So that's what I see as the next steps. Once the manual is out, once the charter is complete, and, you know, we will invite the governments of the world to critically examine the statutory basis. And it's going to be pretty unchallengeable and ironclad.
You know, I think this could go a long way to giving people tremendous hope, even in the early stages, knowing that something like this is on its way, and that it could instill people faith in institutions again, and hopefully reverse the cynicism, which is it's really epidemic cynicism in everything,
yeah,
in everyone, and that's our worst enemy.
Exactly.
Michael, I really appreciate your time with us, and I'd like to do it again. I'd like to talk about the International Court with you again and sort of chart the progress of that with you, and perhaps we can bring on other experts as well. And then at some point, when you have a moment, I would love to have you come on and talk for an hour about the authorship of Shakespeare.
I would be delighted, and it's been a real pleasure, Richard. This is a very high-quality show, and it's been a real pleasure to talk with you.
Appreciate it. Michael Henry Dunn. All right. My website www.richardserrett.com. And again, if you go down to Michael Henry Dunn's name on the homepage there under tonight's show, our 11 p.m. guest, just click on that, and that'll take you right to the website where you can learn all about this international court. And I think it's just absolutely wonderful that this is on the horizon. Something to give us some hope, and we need that desperately. Also, say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S as in Simon, Y-R-E-T-T, at Richard Serrett. Also want to once again draw your attention to the new interactive website for The Conspiracy Show on television. It's brand new. It's called theconspiracyshow.com. It's interactive. You can debate. You can vote as each episode unfolds every week, which, of course, debuts in less than 24 hours across Canada on Vision TV. August 11th. That's Monday night, August 11th, 10 p.m. Eastern. Hope you'll be able to watch each and every episode, and there are 13 brand new ones coming down the pipe. And as always, of course, follow the truth. All right, I'm just racing down the hall here, busy scurrying some little people who should be in bed back to their beds. The twins are with me in the radio station again tonight. The mighty Aphrodite had some work to do, so I brought them in with me, and they are supposed to be sleeping in the boardroom down the hall, and they just showed up here in the studio a few minutes back. But hopefully now they're down and they'll be asleep within minutes. Yeah, right. Welcome. Thanks for inviting me into your home. And hey, how are you enjoying your supermoon thus far? Early this morning, actually, and I'm operating on about 2 hours sleep, driving home from my stint hosting Coast to Coast. So driving up the DVP, the Don Valley Expressway, here in Toronto, at about 5 in the morning. There she was, in all her glory, the supermoon. We've got one more coming our way in September, by the way. Anyway, every time I see not only a supermoon, but especially a supermoon, a full moon, I think of that Jimmy Webb song, which was it's one of my favorite songs, period. It's recorded by Joe Cocker and Glenn Campbell and many people. It's never been a top charter, but it's just one of those standards that everyone seems to like, and it's called "The Moon is a Harsh Mistress." How does that go? See her how she flies, golden sails across the sky, close enough to touch, but be careful if you try. Though she looks as warm as gold, the moon's a harsh mistress. The moon can be so cold. And Jimmy Webb actually was a big science fiction fan, or is a big science fiction fan, and one of his favorite science fiction novels growing up was Robert Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. I've not read that. But I better put that on my list. That was a science fiction novel written, I think, about 1966. There you go. Anyway, a little moon trivia. Whenever I see a supermoon, that song plays through my head. And as I say, we have another one coming our way September 9th, and I'll be singing that song to myself once again. It's that time of the month, and it's time for a visit from our paranormal investigator extraordinaire, Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Now, of late, Rosemary joins me in the latter half of the show, and we get her take on some paranormal stories in the news. We call it our Paranormal News Roundup. But tonight, we've got a special treat for you, because Rosemary is with us for the entire hour. She has a brand new book out. It's called Haunted by the Things You Love, which she's a co-authored with John Zaffis. Zaffis, you may remember, is a paranormal researcher of some renown, and he has a paranormal reality TV show called The Haunted Collector. I believe it's on Sci-Fi. He's not with us tonight, but we do have, of course, Rosemary, and she's no stranger to this topic. We've talked about haunted objects before, but we're delighted to have the whole hour to do so. Again, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, one of the leading experts on the paranormal, with more than 50 books published by major houses on a wide range of paranormal, spiritual, mystical topics, including 9 single-volume encyclopedias, last time I checked anyway. Her work is translated into 15 languages, and she's worked full-time in the paranormal since 1983, researching, investigating, writing, and presenting, and, of course, teaching. Always a pleasure to welcome back Rosemary Ellen Guiley. How are you, Rosemary?
Wow, Richard, it's been quite a weekend. John and I were at a major paranormal conference in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, where we actually debuted our new book, Haunted by the Things You Love, that we'll be talking about this evening. We were both presenting at the conference, and the actual debut in hard print and an e-book was on Friday, and it's gotten off to a terrific start, very well received. John has many, many fans from his long career in the paranormal and also as the star of his own reality show, Haunted Collector, which was all about objects that have spirit attachments and then create havoc with people who acquire them.
Yes, congratulations, first of all, on the book. And what is this for you, number 51, 52, 53? I've lost count, Rosemary.
I'm pushing 60 now,
oh, my.
I think.
Now, is John's program still available on Sci-Fi, The Haunted Collector?
It's being shown in reruns. At the end of season 3, John decided that he wanted to do some other things, pursue some other projects, and he felt that the show had had a very good run. It was one of the top paranormal reality shows on air, and especially on Sci-Fi. And so they're no longer in production, but it still cycles around. And, of course, John's still very active, as I am, doing appearances on media and at events. He's had a very long career in demonology. He's related by blood to the late Ed Warren, who was quite famous with his wife, Lorraine Warren, who's still out and about doing audiences and events, you know, demonic hauntings. And that's really where John got his start with haunted objects, is that some of the cases he worked on very early in his career involved objects that had spirit attachments and were the source of trouble. And then, of course, in my own career, I've come across that too in my investigations. People go out, they get things secondhand. They don't realize that what they're bringing into the home has something extra attached to it. And then people like myself and John get called when all kinds of activity breaks out in a place, and people start having lots of problems, and they can't pinpoint it to anything. So it winds up being these objects. John has collected literally hundreds, probably actually thousands, if you count the things that he's got stored away in boxes. He has a building on his property, a little barn that he calls the John Zaffis Museum of the Paranormal, where he has hundreds of these objects on display.
Have they been exorcised?
They have been, yes. When what happens when we get a case is when we get it identified as object-related, usually the people don't want anything to do with it. They're more than happy to get rid of it. Sometimes they'll even say, please, please, take this thing away. And so then John takes the objects and he neutralizes them, which consists of, a number of different things. One is that a spirit could be detached from an object and sent away. And another is that it's literally bound to the object through prayers and the use of things like sea salt, which has a lot of the same properties that, you know, blessed salt would have. And when they're placed in the museum, then they're inactive. Some of the objects that have very strong spirits attached to them, he will put in a like a glass display case or an acrylic case, because even handling them or bumping into them could jar some activity loose. But in spite of all of that, when you go around and look at all these objects, and I've spent a lot of time in the museum examining things and talking with John about the specifics of individual cases, there's still phenomena that happen.
Even once they've been exorcised? Even once the spirit's been bound to the object or they've been exorcised?
Well, sometimes the things that have been bound, they do get loose a bit. And so people will sometimes see things, or they'll hear voices or feel kind of creepy presences. I have gotten EVP there. There was one of the days that we were doing research for the book. We were walking around the museum, and I just had a digital recorder with me for note-taking purposes. And when I went back to transcribe the tape, at the very end of it, there was a masculine-sounding voice that whispered, "John," just like that.
Oh,
right at the
my.
End.
That would chill you to the bone. And probably
so,
not you.
You know,
you're used to that.
Things are still there.
Well, what's fascinating to me is that there are so many phenomena associated with one single inanimate object. You know, you bring in, let's say you buy a bonnet chest at a flea market. You bring it home, and then a short while later, you've got, maybe it's a string of bad luck. Maybe you're seeing poltergeist disturbances. Maybe you're having, you know, weird dreams, nightmares. You're seeing shadow people. I mean, can one object cause all of these things, or is it usually just one?
Usually there's one spirit attached to an object. And actually, there are a number of explanations for attachments. And one, the most active is spirit. A spirit, for example, let's say an individual has a spirit attachment, and when that person dies, the spirit stays with one of their possessions. And it's sort of an emotional bonding sort of thing. Sometimes people will inadvertently call in spirits. They're involved in mediumship, or they're experimenting with summoning or spirit communications, and they'll call in things, and then those things linger in the environment. They don't go away, and they will attach to objects, but sort of like a snail has a house, you know, and it's a place to live. Sometimes objects are afflicted with curses. We've got several cases in the book, usually involving love relationships gone bad, where people have deliberately cursed something and then given it as a gift, and it's like a peace offering or a present of some sort. And then that spirit comes in like a Trojan horse to wreak havoc in a place. Then there's thought form energy and residual energy from a person, just intense emotions that sort of create an animated thought form energy that can boomerang around. So most of these things do happen with secondhand objects that you find in estate sales and antique shops, but even new objects can become afflicted as well.
Rosemary Ellen Guiley is with us, and co-author of a brand new book, right, just off the printing press. And now, is this published by Visionary?
Yes, it is. By my own press, Visionary Living, we've got it up in Amazon in hard print. It's in ebook format in Kindle, Nook, Kobo, and iTunes.
All right, and it's Haunted by the Things You Love, and it's co-authored by John Zaffis, and of course you'll recognize his name from the Sci-Fi Channel's The Haunted Collector. Listen, why don't, Tim, in the other room, why don't we open up the lines, and if people want to call in, if they have purchased something or brought something into their home, maybe it's an antique, maybe not, and they suspect that that object is haunted or possessed, or they've had a string of bad luck and somehow maybe that object is cursed. Things have changed since they've brought home that grandmother clock. They weren't able to quite put their finger on it, but now they're connecting the dots. We'll find out from Rosemary Ellen Guiley what to do about it, but I'd love to hear your stories. We'll open up the lines as well, and when we come back, more on haunted objects, including those creepy clown dolls that we all love to hate. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Welcome back. Would love to hear your stories if you've purchased an item, brought it into your home, and then all the wheels came off, quite literally, metaphorically and otherwise. Hauntings, bad luck, bad dreams, apparitions, poltergeist activity, and you've connected the dots and suspect it may be that object that you purchased, maybe secondhand, maybe at a garage sale, a flea market, an antique, maybe not an antique, could be a relatively new item. You wouldn't suspect that it could be haunted, but it is. Haunted objects. That's where we're going for the next hour. Rosemary Ellen Guiley is with us, and she has co-authored a brand new book published by Visionary Living, and it is entitled Haunted by the Things You Love, along with John Zaffis. Just a quick note once again, please visit followthetruth.tv. It's a live event I'm hosting November the 16th in Oshawa at the beautiful and historic Region Theater. Six amazing speakers coming to town, all under one roof, and you'll be able to witness their mind-blowing presentations all in one day. November 16th, Region Theater, followthetruth.tv for more details and ticket information. And once again, want to welcome new affiliates KLBM AM and KBKR AM, both in the Portland, Oregon area. KLBM and KBKR in Portland, Oregon. All right, back to Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Now, Rosemary, early in my career, when I was producing talk radio, we received this email. I guess it would have been a fax back then, actually. This couple, they were in Cambridge, Ontario, and they had come into possession of a beautiful hand-carved bench, which they later named the Devil's Bench. And it had the image of the, I think it's the Roman god Bacchus. Is that the Greek god or a Roman god, the god of wine? But it looked sort of devilish. And as soon as they got this bench into their home, the husband lost his job, the wife got sick, and just one string of, you know, misfortune after another. So they got so desperate, they contacted us and wanted to know if we could help them have this thing exercised. So we actually brought it into the studio. And this is going back almost 20 years, you know, before I was a believer in the spirit world and the unseen world and so forth. And so I was sort of flaunting. It was in my office overnight, and in the morning I was sitting on it and saying, this isn't going to, you know, there's no problem with this bench. Luckily, nothing happened, but I was playing with fire. We did have it exercised on the air, and then we actually auctioned it off. That was my first sort of experience with haunted objects. But I want to talk to you about these, because one of the most common objects that are haunted, and we've talked about this recently, there was an item in the news, haunted dolls. One can understand why a spirit would have an attachment to a childhood doll. But give us some for instances from the book, people that have contacted you with haunted or possessed dolls.
Clown dolls rank at the top of the list. And the dolls in general are probably the leading candidates for afflicted objects. They're substitutes for people. They're made like people. Sometimes they're animated electronically, and we give them personalities. You know, kids play with them. Adults like to collect them. They have personalities, and so many spirits find this very appealing to take over a doll and then start acting out. And some of these stories actually get to be Twilight Zone kind of material, you know, something that you think really belongs in a horror film.
My name is Talking Tina, and I want to kill you. Remember?
One of my favorite Twilight Zone episodes where the doll gets back at a daddy who doesn't like the doll. And we find, we haven't found any fatal dolls yet, but we've certainly found dolls that start talking in their owners' heads. People say, I can hear this voice that I know belongs to the doll, and it's telling me things. The dolls will be found moving around on their own. Now, people don't see the dolls scurrying around, but they'll put the doll, for example, on a shelf in a room, and then they'll leave and then come back later, and the doll isn't there anymore. It's somewhere else in the room. It's on the floor, or it's in another location. And that can be very chilling and unsettling. People will have nightmares. They will hear footsteps in hallways and in their bedrooms. They'll see shadow figures. And as you were just describing, also a breakdown of life. People begin to have health problems. Their relationships often suffer, you know, fighting, bickering. A lot of things that you wouldn't automatically label paranormal, but yet are part of a whole syndrome of things that happen when unpleasant spirit activity takes hold in an environment.
I remember my mother she still has it. It's an antique doll. I don't think she had it from childhood. I think she purchased it because it maybe reminded her of a doll she had. And it had the beautiful blue bonnet and like a felt or a velvet dress. And it had those, you know, the antique dolls have those eyes that open and close and so forth. And she had it sitting on her bed. And this is going back late 90s, and I bought her a dog, and I brought the dog home for her. The dog made a beeline to her bedroom and started barking at this doll. And like every day it would go into her room and start barking at this doll. And, you know, we know that pets seem to have this sensitivity to, I guess, psychic phenomena or whatever it is. But maybe that doll needs to be exercised.
Sometimes there are attachments that they're not extreme, but yet animals will pick up on them. People might just have an unsettled feeling like, oh, that kind of gives me the creeps and I don't know why. We get those kinds of cases a lot, too. And then we have these more extreme cases where there are outbreaks of a very unpleasant activity. And I mentioned clown dolls at the top of the list.
They're the worst.
Many people are frightened of clowns. Clowns really are kind of scary. And they also are very prominent figures in a lot of horror stories. And so of all the dolls, and John has dozens and dozens of dolls in the museum, he's got more clown dolls than any other kind.
Now, just a slight digression here. It relates to fear of clowns. I'm not sure if it was Dr. David Jacobs who told me this, or it might have even been you, that a fear of clowns may actually have at its root some sort of an alien abduction scenario. Have you heard that?
I have. I have not encountered that in any of my own cases, but I have read cases where abductees will, as part of the abduction scenario, they'll see like creepy faces show up in the window that look very clown-like. And certainly some of the monstrous forms that come along in the whole play of phenomena as well with abductions, they can look very grotesque and gargoyle-like or clown-like.
Do we understand or the process of how an object becomes either possessed or haunted?
Sometimes we don't know exactly because we can't trace the whole history of an object, but we can speculate based on what we know about certain kinds of objects. For example, in certain parts of the world when masks are made for ritual purposes, those things are made specifically to house spirits. Spirits are invited to live in the mask. When people wear them, they undergo a form of temporary possession where that spirit is permitted to speak and act through the human being. It's a very controlled sort of possession because when the ritual is over, the spirit doesn't stay in the person, but it goes to its house in the mask. Well, collectors who travel around the world and want the real deal, not just the commercial masks made for tourists, which are inert, they go out and acquire these things, and they may not realize that they're bringing home the abode of a spirit. And these spirits are often not happy to be taken out of their native land. They'll be usually put on display in another environment, and if the conditions are right, and sometimes it depends on the people involved and their sensitivity to the spirit world, then the spirit can act out in a very unhappy manner, just like an unhappy child, even. And people have had nightmares. We've got a story in the book where a woman acquired an African mask that was a genuine ritual mask. And among the things that happened to her were nightmares where she was in this foreign setting. She was out in this foreign land, out in a field of grass, and she was with people who were drumming and chanting. And this dream repeated over and over again. We believe that she was tapping into some sort of ritual memories that had come along with The Mask and the Spirit.
Does the material from which the object, piece of furniture or a doll or whatever, does the material it's constructed from make any difference? For example, porcelain versus wood, is one a greater conductor of spirit activity?
Well, we find that all kinds of objects can hold spirits, and we've certainly seen the gamut, every kind of material you can imagine. However, metal is at the top of the list for its ability to retain psychic energy, followed by wood, followed by natural stone, like crystal, field stone, and things like that. So, like this tribal mask I was just talking about, of course, it was carved out of wood. And it even had a hair that was attached to it that had been very carefully braided out of hemp. And sometimes bits of bone are attached to these things, shells and other objects that all are also very good retainers. But those would be the top three. However, we've had porcelain statues. Clothing even can retain very powerful psychic memories and energy if it's been worn with by someone who's had a great deal of emotional attachment to it. So it's almost anything you can think of has the potential to be haunted. Mirrors are another example. Mirrors have a reputation for being doorways to the spirit world. And some of them seem to have let in some very unusual entities into some of the cases that we've dealt with.
Well, let's talk about possessed mirrors, and give me an example from the book, Haunted by the Things You Love.
One of the most unusual mirror cases that I've ever encountered was this mirror that came in it was an ornate mirror in a cherry frame. That was not very nicely carved, had some age on it, probably early to mid-20th century. And a couple bought it at a sale, and they put it in their dining room. Well, the husband was always kind of creeped out by this mirror, but the wife was not affected. We find this in cases, too, where there's a principal focal point. One person in the household gets the brunt of it, even if other people experience something. Well, he would see these shadowy forms go into the mirror. Now, usually in a haunting where a mirror is involved, people will talk about seeing filmy forms and faces in a mirror, and they will see things come out of a mirror. But this is the only case that I have ever heard of where somebody sees things going into a mirror. He never saw them coming out. These dark shadow forms started appearing in his house, and they would react to him seeing them. And as soon as he saw them, they would zip into the dining room, and if he was fast enough, he could catch them disappearing into the mirror. He also started having nightmares, and it seemed like he called them the blobs and the blobby beings. The blobs were talking to him, and they were telling him that his friends and family were out to get him and they couldn't be trusted. Well, his health deteriorated, his relationship with his wife deteriorated, and she didn't see anything wrong. She thought it was all in his head. Even when they had marked poltergeist phenomena in the house, she was unwilling to consider paranormal explanations. This took even after the situation was resolved and John came and took the mirror out, something had attached to the husband, and the couple ended up splitting up. They'd been having kind of a rocky marriage anyway, and this was like the last straw. They split up, but even after he moved out of the house, he continued to have these disturbing nightmares, along with this feeling, this foreboding that something terrible was going to happen to him. And John heard later on that he had been killed in a tragic auto accident. So we're left to wonder, you know, were these blobby beings, were they part of that? Were they trying to warn him? Or were they part of some sort of tragic paranormal game where he was being given advance warning of his doom?
All right, we'll step away for a few moments, Rosemary. Stay where you are, and we'll reconnoiter on the other side and continue to delve into haunted objects, haunted by the things you love, with co-author Rosemary Ellen Guiley, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't move. Welcome back. We are with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. She joins us every month at this time, and we are spending the whole hour with her. And happy to do so. She has a brand new book out, co-authored by John Zaffis. It's entitled Haunted by the Things You Love, and we're discussing haunted objects. Coincidentally, today, I believe it's today, is Scott McClellan's birthday. Now, Scott McClellan, here in the Toronto area, is the man behind Carnival Diablo, which is one of the last sort of traveling sideshows in Canada. And he has a ventriloquist a dummy called Waldo that he actually purchased at auction from a U.S. government warehouse. It had been stowed away and had many, many owners. It was actually carved by the same, I don't know, a puppeteer, I guess, that carved Charlie McCarthy. And Waldo supposedly is connected with about a dozen mysterious deaths over the years. In one case, the owner's house was leveled by a natural gas explosion, and everyone in the house died, and Waldo was left totally intact. And the original owner was a ventriloquist in vaudeville, who was found mysteriously beaten or bludgeoned to death in his dressing room, even though there was no sign of entry and the door was locked from the inside. Waldo, he later learned, he learned this from a psychic who knew nothing of Waldo's past. The psychic simply walked up to the doll and said to Scott, "This dummy was carved from a hangman's tree." And Rosemary Ellen Guiley, I asked you earlier about the material that something is, you know, whether that has anything to do with whether something is haunted. If something is made from a hangman's tree or carved from maybe the wood left over from a coffin or something like that, can that cause something to be haunted or possessed?
It certainly could, and in fact, in all likelihood, it would be. That would be a very bad idea. The wood would be able to retain all of these unhappy emotions, anger, fear, violent death. A hanging is a violent, unpleasant way to die. And all of those psychic energies could be absorbed by the wood, and you know, perhaps dozens and dozens of them, depending upon how many people died there. We have a similar case in the book, a deathbed, a wooden deathbed that came out of Africa, and this is a huge slab of wood on very short legs with a kind of a saddle headrest at one end, and it apparently was used for corpses to be laid out on prior to burial or some sort of an probably not cremation, although some people told us it was cremation, but probably more likely burial. And it was brought over by tourists and collectors to this country. People started getting sick, chronically sick, nightmares. Again, there's a syndrome of things that happen in almost all of these cases: nightmares, shadow figures, bad smells, unusual sounds, and then health issues. And it got passed from them to another set of owners who experienced the same thing, and then finally to a young couple who turned it into a coffee table.
Oh, my.
They thought it was cool to have a deathbed as a coffee table. And the girlfriend got horribly afflicted, and she left. It split the couple up. And at that point, then, the man who had acquired it decided that, well, maybe it was time to get rid of it because he was starting to experience things too. And this is, you know, a piece of wood that we have no idea how many bodies it held, but you can imagine the range of emotions. We don't know how those people died. Some of them might have had lingering, unhappy deaths, or they might have died violently. People coming to view corpses would be in a state of shock, grief, maybe even anger. All of those emotions go into something like that, and it absorbs it like a sponge.
You know, sometimes we look at an object and it might be innocuous, or in fact it may represent, maybe it's a statuette or something, it may represent something that's quite positive. Let's say, for example, an angel or a cherub. And yet, that cherub may actually be haunted, and there's a case in your book.
That was a deliberate curse. And it's a great example of spurned love. A man and a woman had a relationship. They went out for a while. He was more in love with her than she felt about him. She broke off the relationship, took up with another man, and got married and was very happy. You know, she moved on with her life. The man who was left behind never got over her, kept thinking about her, couldn't understand why she left him. She was the perfect woman for him. He wanted her back. And so he decided to try magic to get her back. And she liked angels and cherubs, and she had artwork of them. And so he drew this picture of this little winged cherub. And it's really creepy looking because he gave it coal black eyes. It's got solid black eyes, just like you would think a picture of a demon would have. And he infused it with a magical spell. He taught himself how to do it. He put a spell on the back of the drawing and hid it in the frame, and then called her up and invited her to lunch and said he had a present for her. And she reluctantly went, accepted it. She didn't really like it, didn't want to take a present, but she didn't want to hurt his feelings. And she began to have a lot of problems. She started thinking about her old ex and wearing his jewelry that he had given her. She started fighting with her husband. And it created a lot of problems. It was a deliberate curse.
All right, Rosemary, we'll take a time out. When we come back, we'll continue to explore haunted objects. I want to talk about musical instruments. I love old pianos and old guitars and violins and things like that, and I know there are some cases in the book, haunted by the things that you love, where instruments have become possessed or haunted. We'll explore that with Rosemary Ellen Guiley on the other side, quite literally. The book is called Haunted by the Things You Love, and one of the co-authors, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, joins us. John Zaffis is the other author from the Haunted Collector television series on the science fiction channel, or sci-fi, as it's known in the U.S. Musical instruments, Rosemary, can quite easily be haunted. One can imagine, you know, that people become attached in this life and the next, as it turns out.
We have a case where a woman who was a musician, she collected instruments, and she got this antique violin. And it was in a kind of a shadow box display that she put up on the wall. And shortly after it came in, her house was cold all the time, and she couldn't figure it out. And her cat just seemed to be kind of creeped out a lot, like there was something in the house. She had nightmares. And then she started hearing phantom violin music. And phantom music is not uncommon in a lot of hauntings, a lot of haunted places, but she would wake up in the middle of the night and hear this music, and at first she thought maybe she'd left the TV on or something like that, but she would go out to check, and the music would stop as soon as she got into the room where this violin case was hanging on the wall. She had dark shadow figures in a room. One night she woke up and there was a shadowy figure in the house, and she thought an intruder had broken in, and she went tearing out. And then it seemed that there was nobody in the house. She kind of went back in and checked around, and the house was empty. No one had broken in. So she started to get more and more on edge and more terrified. And then the music kept going in the middle of the night. And then the breaking point came when this thing flew off the wall at her. It's like invisible hands wrenched it off the wall and hurled it, trying to hit her, hurled it with great force, but it missed. And when it crashed to the floor, the odd thing was that the case broke, the violin broke, but the case did not. Here we have a display case with glass, and the case itself remained intact, but the violin was broken in two. So we didn't know much about the history of the violin. She didn't either. The shop where she had bought it, they just knew that it was an antique, but they didn't know who the original owner was. And so here we have, again, we have to speculate as to what the cause was. And the most probable explanation is the original owner of the violin was probably very attached to it. It was probably a highly prized instrument. Maybe someone had had a career with it. And that person's energy had gone into this instrument. It may have gotten passed on after the original owner died. And maybe that energy then took a kind of a thought form, kind of personality. Maybe it didn't like being in a display case. Maybe this kind of spirit-like energy didn't like its new environment, didn't like her, didn't like being relegated to just being on display. There's any number of possibilities we can think of. But once it was removed from the house, then everything went back to normal.
It makes sense that objects that are owned by musicians, artists, maybe writers, these people in life tend to be very intense, dramatic sometimes, a little quirky, eccentric. And I would imagine, and you can disabuse me of this, Rosemary, but people who have that kind of life, who have that kind of personality in life, they would more likely make some sort of an imprint onto an object.
They certainly would. And anyone who has ever studied music and played an instrument would know the intensity that is focused when you are practicing and performing. My husband Joe is a classically trained pianist, and he had a stage career years and years ago, and just hours and hours devoted to practice. You bond with your instrument, and it becomes like an extension of you. So it's very easy to see how these sorts of things could acquire a haunting presence.
Well, you know, here's something that's very strange as you're talking to me about this occurred to me. And last night I was hosting Coast to Coast, and I had Gary Patterson on the program, who writes about, you know, Tales from the Rock and Roll Graveyard. And, you know, he specializes in talking about musicians that have had such tragedy in their life and died untimely deaths. And we all know about the drug abuse and the alcoholism mental illness, really, within the rock and roll world. And I'm wondering maybe whether some of that might be attributed to the actual instruments that these musicians are walking around with. Maybe they bought it secondhand and they have no idea. Is that possible? That's why a lot of people in the music industry, live such tragic lives.
It's certainly an interesting theory, Richard, and has a lot of plausibility to it. Many musicians prize getting the instrument of somebody else, especially who is famous. And maybe the energies that come along with those instruments don't translate well to the new owner. It's not a good thing to do. So it could very likely be part of that mix.
Yeah, you think of all the artists, for example, that have died in plane crashes, a lot of musicians, you know. And now, granted, the odds are that, you know, they're in a high-risk business. They're flying more than the average person. Sometimes they fly in bad weather. Their promoter says, no, you got to be in Louisiana tomorrow night, come hell or high water. You know, thinking about people like Jim Reeves, Jim Croce, Patsy Cline, Buddy Holly. You know, maybe it wasn't just the fact they were flying a lot. Maybe that guitar... they got it secondhand somewhere. Well, how do you know? Let's say you've got your house packed with old instruments, or you're running a music shop, or an antique shop. How do you know which piece is responsible? How do you go about finding that out?
The evidence is really, it's like it hides in plain sight. And in almost every case that we take on like this, the people, the victims will say that they had a funny feeling about something when they acquired it, but they chose to ignore it. They passed it off as their imagination, or maybe they didn't believe in the supernatural. There were so many other reasons why they absolutely had to have this object that they overrode their own gut intuition. An object that has troubling energy attached to it can be felt. It's palpable. When people look at it, handle it, they might get a queasy feeling, an uneasy feeling, or put off, and they don't pay attention to it. So that's one of the biggest giveaways right there. And one of the things that we advise people at the end of the book, where we talk about, you know, how do you recognize these things and what do you do about it, is that when you are out shopping, especially for secondhand things, pay attention to how your body is responding to an object when you look at it and handle it. Sometimes people get these, like, irresistible attractions to things for various reasons, and that seems to be part of it, too, where they're kind of lured in without realizing it. But it's still not a happy feeling. It's more of a fatal attraction kind of energy. And they'll almost always say to us, I knew there was something strange about that thing. Or when I picked it up, it felt really weird to me. In the case of some people, especially young people who really like to go and look for weird things so that they can have unusual conversation pieces, that's exactly what they're looking for, and they don't realize that they're actually out looking for trouble.
I mentioned Scott McClelland earlier, who has this traveling sideshow up here called Carnival Diablo, and he's also a ripperologist, which is, for those not in the know, these are sort of, I hasten to use the word fans, or I'd rather not use the word fans, but that are enthusiasts of the Jack the Ripper case. And he's a collector. And one of Jack the Ripper's victims, I think she was the third victim of the serial killer, was Elizabeth Stride. She was known as Long Liz. She was a prostitute. She was particularly tall. And when she was found, in her hand were some coins, some English coins, money. And he owns, apparently, one of those coins. I don't know how this was verified. But he handed them to me, and he wanted me to look at them. And I tell you, I felt something strange. I don't know if it was because I made the association that these were once held by one of Jack the Ripper's victims, or whether there was some sort of an energy there. You got to be careful, you know, when people start passing this stuff around. How can you protect yourself?
The best thing to do if you're going to deal with the spirit world is to understand what's out there, to have a very good buffer around you. Now, everybody has a different threshold of sensitivity, and sometimes the victims in these cases are unusually sensitive to the spirit world. They sort of make ideal hosts. That they've got something in their energy field that spirits are able to latch onto and energize themselves from. Then other people have very good buffers around them. You could even bring a haunted object into their environment, and it would remain rather inert because it hasn't got anything to literally feed off of. Just as a common sense measure to understand your intuition, to know how it functions, I always recommend to people in all walks of life that a daily practice of meditation and prayer is a bit, it's like going to the psychic gym. It builds up that buffer around you. But paying attention to your gut instincts is really the number one thing that the average person should develop. We're all intuitive. We've all got that. And it can be our biggest ally in keeping the unwanted out of our home environments.
Very quickly, because we're almost out of time here, but, you know, vintage clothing are very popular now, or not even vintage clothing necessarily. People looking for deals on clothes will go to a thrift shop. Where, you know, if you know your labels, and, you know, you can really find some amazing articles of clothing, and sometimes the vendor doesn't know what he's got or she has, and you can end up buying a designer dress for $12 or something. People have to be on the lookout and be very careful and mindful of that, don't they?
Here again, the emotions of the original owner can linger in the clothing, and one of the best examples we have is a West Point dress cadet jacket that dated to about the turn of the 20th century. It was purchased by a young woman who wanted it for a fashion piece, and she loved it. She wore it all the time. She began having nightmares. They turned out to be scenes of fighting that we felt were World War I. And our conclusion was that whoever had owned that dress jacket, even though the jacket had not been used in combat, it still had a great deal of emotional significance to probably a young man who had it, that he had probably been killed in World War I because some of her nightmares were being in trenches and people being gassed, and you know, they used the chloroform gas.
Sure.
There.
Well,
and,
just goes to show you, you got to be careful.
Saw blood on herself, and all of it was held in the jacket. All of those memories.
All right, Rosemary, got to run. Wish we had more time. Congratulations on the new book, "Haunted by the Things You Love" by Visionary Press.
Thank you very much, Richard. Good night.
All right, good night. My thanks to Tim Spreen, all of you for listening at home. In the meantime, don't be afraid. Nothing concealed that won't be revealed. Nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.